This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Scientists have found a new word to describe the potential impact of Hurricane Sandy on the East Coast. They're calling it Frankenstorm.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock, the world's emergency room. At least that's what it feels like lately, as we begin to taste the high-carbon future here on planet Earth. The North Americans are bragging about pumping out more oil from dirtier sources, even as drought kills off the crops, and now a humongous record hurricane spins up on the East Coast. We'll talk with Green Radio reporter Daphne Wisham just as the storm hit the North American capital, Washington, D.C. How is the brand new climate spiking these storms like steroids? I'll tell you what top scientists are saying. At the other end of the world, following fires and floods of their own, the Australians are straining to break their own dismal carbon record. My head hurts trying to understand why such nice people want to double their coal exports. Australia is already the biggest coal exporter in the world, keeping black smokestacks in Japan, Taiwan, China, and now India, pouring out more and more carbon dioxide into the overloaded atmosphere. We'll get the goods from down under from Greenpeace Pacific Atmosphere and Energy campaigner Georgina Woods. You'll get to breathe that pollution, you know, and we all get hit with the climate change. I'll wrap up with another story with warning sirens all over it. Canada is already building its own Yucca North, a porous hole where they plan to dump nuclear waste. The best they can do is the worst they can do. The supposed deep geological deposit is just a very shallow hole in limestone caves right beside the Great Lakes. It's up water from millions of people in Chicago, Cleveland, Buffalo, Toronto, and Montreal. Bernane Woods of Northwatch tells us how the aging Bruce Nuclear Plant, the largest running nuclear complex on the planet, and this new storage facility threatens the whole world. I'm Alex Smith. Take a deep breath. We're all heading into a state of ecological shock.
Radio EcoShock.
Let's start with that story covered by every network and the part that they leave out. Global climate disruption makes deadly and costly storms like Hurricane Sandy much more violent. More than two decades ago, scientists told us this would happen, and now it's here. How does it work? Well, first you need to know we've created far more heat on this planet than we feel here on land. The world's great oceans are absorbing more than half the heat held in by those greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. The Gulf Stream, that great ocean current running off North America's east coast until it warms Britain and Northern Europe, it is heating up. According to the UK Met Office, the government body measuring such things, there is a huge area off the mid-Atlantic coast that is 2.3 degrees Fahrenheit or 1.3 degrees hotter than average. That doesn't sound impressive, but that much heat over a giant expanse of ocean is tremendous. But it gets worse. The Gulf Stream itself is currently 5 degrees Fahrenheit above normal. Hurricane Sandy cruised up this Gulf Stream, gathering up both energy and extra water moisture in her half-continent-sized clouds. As meteorologist and former storm chaser Jeff Master tells us, the Atlantic was unusually warm right to the end of October, making Sandy stronger and wetter. Did the record amount of open ocean in the Arctic this summer help the Atlantic stay warmer longer? Scientists aren't sure yet. Jennifer Francis of Rutgers, a recent guest on Radio EcoShock, says the blocking weather in the last 2 weeks is consistent with what her team observed from the melting of sea ice in the Arctic. Kevin Trenberth of the National Center for Atmospheric Research agrees the Atlantic currents are 5 degrees Fahrenheit warmer in the Gulf Stream than normal, and he attributes 1 degree of that directly to global warming. But he doesn't believe the Arctic melt this summer and fall contributed to it. The jury is still out on that, but the vast majority of scientists agree megastorms like Sandy are more likely to become the new normal due to climate disruption by human-induced emissions of greenhouse gases. Of course, there are skeptics, some of them well paid by the fossil fuel lobby. For example, Patrick J. Michaels of the Cato Institute, who we know has received lots of money from the Koch brothers and others in the powerful oil and coal lobby. He says a storm like Sandy could have happened on a cooling planet as well. He writes Andy Revkin of the New York Times, quote, "I predict confidently that we will survive Sandy, which should not be a tropical cyclone at landfall," end quote. Another ploy used by the climate deniers is to find papers showing there were big storms hundreds of thousands or millions of years ago. In many of those cases, carbon dioxide was high then, too, and there was a hothouse world. And anyway, so what? We're dealing with now, and humans have ramped up the odds of getting a lot of big storms in a short period of time. Meanwhile, on the ground, what was it like? On Monday night, as the big storm landed in Washington, D.C., I spoke with Daphne Wysham. As the cell phone tower swayed, she called for calm. The mainstream media is delivering news while keeping up the great American silence about the role of climate disruption in this unprecedented storm. That's what we're going to talk about with Daphne Wysham, the host of the long-running green radio show Earthbeat and now a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington. I reached Daphne in her home in D.C. just as Hurricane Sandy was washing ashore on Monday. Daphne, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, and I hope the line remains good during the storm. We've got about 70 mile per hour winds outside right now.
Well, yeah, before we get to that storm, what is happening in Washington?
Well, I'm looking out, and the trees are blowing pretty violently. There's been just constant rainfall since last night. We've had record rainfall here in the nation's capital. The government is shut down. The metro or the underground subway has been shut down. They're asking only emergency personnel to be out on the streets. So we still have power, but we're waiting for power to go off anytime.
And you've been busy writing about the aspect of climate change for places like the Huffington Post and Fire Dog Lake. What are you telling folks?
One of the things that I was writing about in my column today is basically the title is on not scaring ourselves to death, moving beyond the adrenaline rush of Frankenstorm to real energy independence. And my point is that, you know, if you turn on your television set, it's almost like we go through the same exercise with each one of these major hurricanes. We almost get an adrenaline high out of watching, you know, the waters rising and the weathercasters going out into thigh deep water and standing at the ocean's edge, buffeted by the high winds. And, you know, we sort of get caught up in the drama and almost expect it. And yet, you know, it's sort of ironic that this is all happening right around Halloween when people like to scare themselves to death. And what I'm suggesting is that by sort of getting caught up in the adrenaline rush, we're really fooling ourselves again and again, just as children do every Halloween. And we're not acting like the adults we need to act like, which is basically to understand over and over again when we keep getting buffeted by stronger and stronger storms, there is something very serious happening that we need to pay attention to. And that, of course, as you know, is that we're dealing with a climate crisis of enormous proportions. And there is absolutely no coincidence in the fact that the storm is as great as it is, given that the Arctic is melting, the oceans are warming, there's more energy in the atmosphere. And so, of course, we are going to be seeing an increase in the intensity of both the storms as well as the rainfall. What goes up must come down with evaporation. So it's no surprise. What is surprising is just how good we are at fooling ourselves and pretending that, this is some major shocking storm that has nothing to do with the climate crisis. You know, my hope is that this will be, if Katrina wasn't the wake-up call, hopefully Sandy or Frankenstorm is the wake-up call that this country and our political leaders desperately need in order to get us on the path towards the kind of energy revolution that we absolutely need to take to protect our future and the future of our grandchildren.
Well, you know, during the Republican National Convention, presidential candidate Mitt Romney laughed at efforts to stop rising seas. And now this storm surge from Hurricane Sandy is threatening the North American coast, the East Coast, as never before. Bill McKibben of 350.org suggested Romney might want to rethink that. What has storm surge got to do with rising seas?
Well, of course, as you know, with, you know, we've got the sea level rising due to climate change. We know that that is happening. That's part of the background. And then when you have more and more intense storms, of course, that results in higher waves. And of course, we've got a full moon at the same time, so we're having an even higher tide. And all of that adds up for a region of the country like New York City, which is already so close to the edge of high tide at good times, to a disaster potentially unfolding. And we're hearing that Atlantic City is underwater. Other parts of the New Jersey shore are facing massive deluges potentially. And this is, of course, exactly what the scientists have predicted. What people like NASA's top climate scientist, James Hansen, have said is actually we didn't anticipate that it would be this bad this soon. It's happening a lot faster than many of the top scientists expected. And as the Arctic melts, of course, that increases the intensity of these storms, because where once it was sort of a buffer for the ups and downs and the temperatures and so on, and it's now, with the Arctic receding, there's more heat being held in the polar region. Of course, that heat has to escape one way or another, and that energy is churning up more and more storms.
And, you know, a lot of folks don't know this, but the extra heat that's trapped by these rising greenhouse gases in the atmosphere is going straight into the ocean. And that seems to be an important part of this story, even with Hurricane Sandy.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm wondering if this will, we finally had President Obama mentioning climate change in response to an interview he did, I think, with MTV recently. But it's really too bad that this didn't come up at all in the debates, and that the politicians in general seem to be backpedaling as fast as possible away from any discussion of the issues around climate change at a time when we desperately need to have this conversation. So as you know, I'm just back from Germany and Denmark, and the conversations in those countries couldn't be more different and more hopeful in the sense they are really taking very seriously the need to move off of fossil fuels as well as away from nuclear power in the aftermath of Fukushima. And maybe this will be what it takes to finally have the conversation on climate change if New York City goes underwater. We'll have to wait and see.
Well, there have been scientists and frustrated green activists thinking only a major disaster will force this change in thinking in America. And I am looking forward to hearing more from you about what's happening in Germany and Denmark. I know it's just like a different world over there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking, too, when we get these huge rainfall events, they can happen even without a hurricane. They've been popping up all over the world. In New England, the biggest impact of that tropical storm Irene was the relentless rain, the flooding out of roads and homes, whole communities. Can you talk about extreme rainfall events and global warming?
Well, you know, I mean, one of the things we keep hearing about in all different parts of the world is record rainfall. Pakistan, a vast majority of Pakistan was underwater for 2 years in a row. We hear about flooding in the Philippines, in other parts of Asia, China, and of course in this country, in the United States, we've had record flooding. And, you know, again, it has a lot to do with the extra heat in the atmosphere and how that results in an increase in evaporation of water. And, of course, it must come down. And so it's coming down in some places in record levels, and it's not coming down in other areas in parts of the country where we've seen record drought. And, unfortunately, there's sort of a vicious cycle. Once a part of the country gets very, very dry, as in the Southwest, it's predicted that it'll be even drier and that those desert areas will expand. So it's almost as if climate change is sort of putting different climate cycles on steroids. And what was once a relatively moist area, a rainy part of the country, may all of a sudden become just one deluge after another. And the drier regions will become even more dry. You know, I think we've got a very short window of time, as you know, to turn this around. It's possible we may have already passed certain tipping points, but time is of the essence. We are making some changes. I mean, I don't want to say it's all gloom and doom. We have somehow, if the numbers are to be believed, we've actually reduced our emissions in the United States. I'm somewhat skeptical of those numbers because I don't think they're counting the emissions from fracking that's going on at a record pace. I think they haven't calculated the fugitive emissions from all the fracking that's going on. However, if the numbers are to be believed due to both the economic downturn and to people driving more efficient cars and so on, it seems that at least we're not headed in, you know, as bad a direction as we could have a few years ago. So there are signs of some changes going on, and we just have to build on that and build on the momentum. Of course, the tar sands in Canada are going to be our biggest challenge, both for this country and for Canada. And hopefully that won't be a foregone conclusion that the pipeline will be built regardless of who gets elected. I'm afraid that we have both Obama and Romney suggesting that they're going to move forward with that pipeline, which would be very, very challenging for those of us who care about climate change.
And for all the money they think they're going to make out of that terrible oil that they produce, we're going to lose a lot more. We just had Munich Re, the insurance company that kind of insures other insurance companies. And they're saying that there's going to be, you know, North America is being very hard hit by these extreme climate events. They expect to see more. So we're going to lose billions. I see a point at which cities will struggle to recover from whether it's storms or droughts, just time after time. Maybe some places won't be able to come back from these things.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, we're already talking tens of billions of dollars just from this one storm. And that, I think, is just the wind damage. We're not talking about water damage. Tens of billions of dollars just from one storm. And you imagine, what could we do with tens of billions of dollars of investment in clean energy? We could certainly do an awful lot more in terms of getting towards energy independence, which both candidates say that they claim to hold dear. So I don't know. I mean, will we act rationally after this storm? It remains to be seen. We probably will continue our short-term thinking, but if enough of us keep pushing and speaking out on and connecting the dots between this record storm and the record greenhouse gas emissions in the Earth's atmosphere, maybe we'll start to see some changes.
Well, I'm hoping you're hunkered down in a safe place. Maybe the power will go out. Are you ready for 2-3 days without electricity?
Yeah, I've got food all stored up in a cooler and plenty of candles and batteries and emergency rooms, and I think we'll be fine. I'm more worried about people that are literally losing their lives in places like Haiti as a result of our energy profligacy, but I guess it's going to take a while for us to wake up to this.
We were talking with Green Radio reporter Daphne Wysham, the longtime host of Earthbeat and now a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. She is in Washington, D.C., just as the storm lands. This is recorded on October 29th. Daphne, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for all that you do, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You can find links to Daphne Wysham's article at Fire Dog Lake and lots more on the link between climate change and hurricanes like Sandy in my show blog at ecoshock.info, ecoshock.info. You might think humans would learn from disasters like this. Apparently not yet. Australia suffered a terrible drought for years, ending farming in parts of the country. The Black Saturday bushfires of 2009 killed 173 people. They were horrific. Then torrential rains flooded out coastal cities and towns. No matter, mate. Australia is steaming full ahead to expand their coal exports into a world climate-wrecking status equal to Canada's infamous tar sands. Here is what you haven't heard. Between Canada's tar sands and Australia's massive coal exports, we make two of the nicest climate wreckers around. Both countries are ramping up dirty carbon production to feed their economies. Let's tune in to what is happening down under with Georgina Woods, Senior Climate and Energy Campaigner for Greenpeace Australia Pacific. Georgina, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Well, before we talk about the huge expansion, how big are Australia's coal exports now?
It fluctuates year to year, but at current levels, Australia is exporting around 300 million tonnes per annum of coal. Some of that is coking coal for making steel, and some of it's thermal coal for electricity.
And where does that put you in the ranking of world coal exporters?
Our total coal exports are the biggest export volume in the world. We are second to Indonesia in the thermal coal ranks, but we're certainly right up there and have a big influence on the Asian coal market.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. Who is buying Australian coal?
Well, traditionally, it's been predominantly Japan and South Korea and Taiwan that buy coal from Australia. Japan's a big coal burner and doesn't have coal of its own, so it's been a big customer country of Australia's for many years. More and more in recent years and in the future, we're going to be selling a lot of the coal that we mine to China and India, who are both expanding their coal-fired generation capacity at the moment.
Well, let's talk about the 9 mega coal mines now being proposed in Australia. Please, Georgina, take as long as you want to tell us about those.
Well, the report that Greenpeace Australia Pacific released recently focused in on one region where coal mining is expanding. It's important to understand that the Galilee Basin, which is the region we were talking about in our report, isn't the only place where coal exports are expanding in Australia. There are dozens of new coal mines proposed in various parts of the states of New South Wales and Queensland. But the Galilee Basin is special because it's a region entirely new to coal mining. It's a long way from the coast, and the coal mines that are being proposed for that region are exceptionally large. So currently, the largest coal mine in Australia produces around 30 million tonnes of coal every year. And two of the mines currently proposed for the Galilee Basin will produce 60 million tonnes of coal every year. So it is going to be coal mining on a scale that is unprecedented in Australia. At the moment, there are 9 coal mines proposed for that region that have production capacity defined. And so we know that the intentions of the coal industry to pull around 330 million tonnes of coal from that region every year at full production.
That is amazing. So where do the Aboriginal people of Australia stand on this massive expansion of coal mining?
Well, there are different communities of Aboriginal people around the country with different languages and different, you know, organisations. In Queensland, there is native title law that requires Aboriginal people to negotiate, to provide agreement to enterprises like this. One of the coal mines in the Galilee Basin, the company has already negotiated agreements with Aboriginal communities for that mine, but the others are going to need to do that. And it's possible that there will be cultural heritage impacts of these coal mines and of the rail lines that will go to the coast because they are so large. And it's an area that's been, until now, given over to grazing cattle, which isn't a high disturbance occupation.
Okay. Well, I'd like to switch over a little bit to the role of the media in Australia about this. Could you tell the world about Australia's sweetheart, Gina Rinehart?
Yes. Gina Rinehart is the chairman of a company called Hancock Prospecting, and she comes from a mining family in Western Australia. Her father was an iron prospector, and her company has a great interest in iron mining, which is really big in Western Australia. Her company basically developed several of the projects in the Galilee Basin, two of the mines and one of the coal ports that's being proposed to export this coal, and then sold a large chunk of the ownership of those projects to an Indian company called GVK. So Rinehart's company still does own an interest in it, and she is a very vocal advocate for mining interests in Australia and sort of takes up political causes in the interest of mining and free trade and, the ability of mining companies to import labour and sort of generally kind of runs an agenda of freeing up interests for mining to be able to mine where they like and operate in the way that they choose.
And I understand Ms. Rinehart is a huge fan of climate deniers like Andrew Bolt. She wants to give them top billing in the newspapers and television stations she buys. Is that right?
Rinehart has been connected to climate-denying people. Certainly she, in the press, has been associated with a move. She bought part of one of the television channels here and installed Andrew Bolt in a program there. That was certainly the way it was reported. And it's also reported that she's interested in buying, and she has bought a large stake in one of our big newspaper companies here as well. Yes, there are, there is sort of quite a intense climate denial movement in Australia, and we get a lot of sort of visiting climate deniers from the United States and the United Kingdom brought out by various business interests in Australia to try and sow seeds of confusion in the community about global warming.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from Sydney, Australia. We are talking with Greenpeace senior climate and energy campaigner Georgina Woods. Georgina, here is what shocks me about the rapid expansion of the coal and of climate denial in Australia. It seems like such an insult to all those who lost their lives in the horrible fires, the big floods, and those agricultural droughts. The farmers, some of them committed suicide. They were so severe, and it happened time and time again in recent years. How can anyone doubt the climate is changing after all that?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, I suppose, because climate change is such a big problem and has so many complex manifestations that it's hard for people to, be really clear about it. And it's easy for people to sow confusion if they choose to. I think that's also, it's a symptom of people being frightened by a problem that is much larger than any we've faced before and much more complex. And so it's natural for people to cling on to ideas that it's not a problem, that it's not happening. And those are the kinds of vulnerabilities that are exploited by fossil fuel companies and climate deniers who don't want our community to act to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels.
And then we have the simple fact that the Great Barrier Reef, a treasure to Australia and to the world, is bleaching and dying, mainly due to global warming. Are Australians ready to let these great coral reefs die to provide more short-term jobs in the coal mining industry?
Well, the Great Barrier Reef is really at the centre of the coal debate in the state of Queensland in Australia. Because it is so obviously threatened by climate change, and recently a paper was released that showed that even 2 degrees of global warming, which is a commitment that our government has made with governments around the world, is probably going to be devastating for coral reefs and the Great Barrier Reef more particularly. So it's, right up there as being under threat from climate change. But it's also right immediately now under threat from the coal industry because there are up to 9 new coal export terminals being proposed to be built for the Great Barrier Reef coast by various coal corporations. So it's the icon of the coal campaign in Queensland because it's threatened by coastal development. And just last week, 2 weeks ago, our federal environment minister gave approval for a 60 million tonne coal export terminal to be built in the Great Barrier Reef World Heritage Area to export coal from the mine that's partly owned by Reinhardt's company. So in Australia, yes, the people have a great emotional attachment to the reef and take very seriously their responsibility to protect the reef. But right now we're seeing utter failure of governments and certainly corporations to put the interests of the Great Barrier Reef ahead of their short-term financial and political interests.
So, Georgina Woods, how did you become part of the climate movement?
Well, I live in a city called Newcastle in New South Wales in Australia, which is the biggest coal exporting port in the world. We export now over 100 million tonnes from Newcastle to the Asian coal markets every year. And I've always been a conservationist. I was involved in forest protection and marine protection. And living in this city, which is a beautiful city, but which is emotionally and economically tied to the coal industry and was part of expanding coal from Australia and therefore climate change, made me realise that I needed to be part of ensuring that Australia wasn't driving global warming and, eventually killing forests and ecosystems and people around the world. So I guess I was intimately acquainted with the coal industry, having grown up in a region that has traditionally been one of the bigger mining regions in the country.
We'll be right back in just a minute with more Radio EcoShock.